tell me about the stories that you write. Why do you choose to write plays?
That's a good question.
And that is a big part of my current thought process is I lean towards more kind of social justice, political, but hidden in the plays often. And I'm finding that they're not really in fashion right now. But I, you know, originally wrote plays because I thought being a playwright seemed like a really interesting life, and it seemed like a way to talk about things with an audience that you couldn't talk about in the same way you could a book or a film. Like the live performance added a way to talk about really interesting things and sit next to someone and have an experience that you couldn't have any other way. And I could sit in the back of the audience. And it didn't have to be me up there. And so yeah, I've been doing it for 26 years. I've been doing it a long time. And so yeah, a lot of, you know, I think I usually start with a question about the world, and that's where my plays usually start.
Are there any specific issues within social justice that you're really interested in?
Well, the wars have been a big part of my plays probably since we started them ages ago. Because I grew up in the military. Mm. My dad was a Marine, and I grew up pretty anti-war. So, when we started Iraq and Afghanistan, I felt like theater was a good place to talk about that. So I think they've been in, there's been some mention of the wars in pretty much at least a third of my plays recently. Because wow. I feel like someone's got to keep it alive, you know, because it's, you know, if you don't know someone in the military, there's a lot good chance you don't know anyone fighting in these wars. So, yeah, that's been a big part of it in the last few years, I would say. Yeah.
Which writers do you take inspiration from?
Well, I would say when I first started, like Lillian Hellman was a huge inspiration because I felt like both her life and her plays kind of were of a spoke to her beliefs, you know, and her interest, and that I was really attracted to that. And I think Sam Shepard too, in a way, and just they both, you know, made the life of a playwright look really romantic and interesting, and yeah, those were two big kind of inspirations. And Chekhov was big also because I thought he really had an interesting life. So it was the lives of the playwrights as much as their work when I was young to kind of like guide me.
Do you think the life that you imagined as a playwright has really lived up to what you thought it was going to be, or is it different?
I think when you're in your 20s, no one can tell you, you know, it's going to be hard and you really believe it because you want to do what you want to do. And I think it has been really hard, you know. It's a lot of slim times, but also really interesting. So it has been as interesting as I wanted it to be, but matched with a lot of struggle, you know. But really great people in the field, you know. I've met some really great friends in my career. And so I can't imagine doing anything else. But I have made sacrifices to do it, you know.
Yeah.
I would say if someone had painted the picture, I would have said, oh, well, I don't get to do that, but I get to have this great life, so.
Mm-hmm. Do you think women writers tell different stories from men writers?
Different stories? I think they tell stories in different ways. Mm. Yeah, that's a good question. I don't know if the stories are different. I think that the way they might express the story is different, you know, because you could have two playwrights write, a male and a female write a play about a war scenario, for example, and they both might be tackling the same subject, but the woman's play may just look different. Mm-hmm. And I can't really speak to what that difference is, honestly. I can't say gender-wise you can say a woman's play is this and a man's play is this, because I think it's not that general.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Which writers do you think are doing it right in terms of gender parity? If I don't know if you have any thoughts about that.
What do you mean by, like, could you, what would be an example? What do you mean doing it right?
I don't know. Like, if you saw a play and you thought just the casting allowed it to be really that the men and women actors or, you know, characters were really, really on the same level, that they were the same depth, or that they all, you know, they all had their own power or something like that. That might be one example.
Trying to think. Because I don't... It's interesting. I don't think about that when I'm watching plays as much as when I'm thinking about them being produced. I think that... like I might say, I mean, sometimes it's more of a negative thing. I might say David Mamet writes terrible female characters. And yet, for a film, he can write a really interesting character. You know, he might... Or Neil LaBute. I don't like the way he portrays women. I think it's really offensive most of the time. But I'm trying to think of female writers that I even am comparing the way that men and women are represented, you know? I think I'm often just looking at the story and maybe not even aware if it's coming through gender. That's a good question. I'm trying to think. Or even plays I've seen recently.
Or maybe is there a woman character that really has stood out to you or struck you in some way?
The writers that, you know, I feel like it's not that time in American theater. I think it's a time of pastels more than bright colors, if that makes sense, for characters. And I think, you know, there's a playwright named Taylor Mack who is does most of his perform? He writes and performs in drag, and I think that he, as a person and as a performer and an artist, is actually doing things with gender that are more interesting because it rides a line. And I don't think it's popular, honestly, to see super strong female characters and super strong male characters right now.
So you said
you heard that. I don't know if you've heard that from other people, but I feel like you know, I'm trying to think the last play that really like had a female character like that was August Osage County, where it came when she said, "I'm in charge now."
Yeah, that's my favorite play. I had a really visceral reaction when I saw that play because I really. Like, I don't actually know how to describe it, but it was really amazing because I was laughing, but that was because I didn't know any other reaction.
Right.
You know, because you were seeing the power on stage sort of being dished out, and
right.
It was just amazing.
Right, and it, but as a movie, it didn't work as well.
No.
And that's, you know, the daughter and the mother in that play were, those were bold colors, I think.
Yeah.
You know? And I saw a production in New York, a play called Bad Jews, and it had a female character. Interesting, and I saw a lot of people walk out because the character was so of a note, one note, written by a male. And I'm trying to think other... Yeah, it's just like I said. It's not the fashion.
So you said it. You said it was pastel colors. I really like that word because I mean that really, you know, pastel versus bright. But then, if the characters themselves are kind of put in a different, I don't know. I won't say the backboard burner, but like, what kind of becomes the focus of the plays? Is it issues like you were talking about with war or?
situations or dynamics, emotional issues versus like high big drama, like August Osage County. That was what? How many years ago? Maybe five. There's been a shift in the last 5 years. You know, I just don't see that many like really. I did see a hyper masculine play called Reunion that was kind of like a theater version of The Hangover, you know?
Yeah.
But I was like, eh. Yeah, I don't know. We talk a lot about gender in theater, but I feel like on stage we're not seeing it played out right now. Maybe those plays are being written and they're not being. It's not the taste of the moment.
That's interesting. Yeah.
It's not a huge political environment right now, which is shocking considering the state of the country and the world. You know, it's a little bit more, like I said, pastel, domestic, American stories rather than.
I wonder why.
Yeah. Yeah, I was just talking earlier about it, and I could just be my. Lens on it, but I think that it's post-recession, a little bit of safe, button down the hatches a little bit on everything. Mm-hmm. Like, let's not, I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I can't put my finger on why. And maybe someone would argue differently, but I just don't feel like the plays are, I don't even think of New York, you know? It's not big. Get in there and you know, shout it out. You know?
How would you define a strong woman character for you? Is it important to write strong women characters, and if so, why? I guess that we already sort of touched on that
right.
a little bit, but
yes, it is definitely important. And I think because I'm older, I'm in my 40s, and that's the stories I'm telling are kind of women in their midlife, and there's a lot of actresses that age that I feel like I want to write for, and the stories are really interesting at that, you know, like you're questioning your entire life, and children, if you did have children, you didn't have children, yeah, and it's still a very male-dominated society, so I feel like there's always something to rub up against in that way. And
do you write for specific actresses?
I do if I know the company, or and, you know, I often have an actress in mind when I'm writing. Mm-hmm. She may not end up doing the part, but yeah, there's definitely people in my head when I'm writing. Yeah, it would be interesting to, you know, like, there's this woman named, of course I'm spacing your name all of a sudden, who I love. sorry, it's like, it's the coastal trip.
No, it's okay.
It'll come to me. But she'd be great. Like, she's an actress in New York, plays often really strong, interesting characters because she's one of these actresses that never makes the sentimental choice, which makes for a really interesting character. You know, it's she kind of resists the emotion first thing, and that's not always common. You know, a lot of actors want to show you that they can feel many things, and she would be. And of course, if I can think of her name, because I'm so tired. I'll get it. It'll come to me. Once I stop thinking about it, it'll come to me.
Have you ever started writing a play and the gender of a main character changed during the writing process?
Well, that's a good question. The gender change, no.
No?
Mm-mm. And then I have to think, did I?
Mm-mm. When you envision a play, do you really see the characters right away, or do they kind of gradually come in?
Usually at the center of the play, I usually see who that is. Mm-hmm. And I write a lot of male characters, too. Like, mm-hmm. my last few plays have been male-driven. At the center, which couldn't tell you why. Mm-hmm. Maybe exercising that muscle. Mm-hmm.
Do you find it hard to write for men, or for no?
Not certain types of men. You know, I think maybe I'm writing my ideal. You know, they're complicated but it's. I think it's. It's. There are times when I want to write men. Mm. I just want to live in that world, in a way. Females feel very familiar. Mm. You know, and sometimes writing men is like, you know, again, using a paint analogy, using a color that takes more effort for me to really get it right and true. And
how does it work when you're trying to establish a relationship, when you're sort of starting to figure out what, between two characters, mm-hmm. what past they share, what, I don't know, just maybe what troubles they've had between each other or something like that?
Well, I'm not, you know, some writers map out their entire story, and I don't do that. I think that is the excitement of writing for me, is that unraveling, mm-hmm. you know, because they'll start their, you know, it's a basic, they're asking each other questions or they're ignoring each other's questions, and that will lead me down a certain path, like, oh, didn't answer that. Mm-hmm. Still didn't answer that. So what is that hiding? And then I'll finally discover, I might not discover it until 20 pages later, mm. or then, you know, 3 days later that I'm, and that's really an exciting moment going, oh, okay. So that means blah, 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 you know?
Yeah.
And that's the part that I love about writing, is having those moments. So I kind of keep them a mystery from my, you know, from myself.
Yeah.
Yeah, because just to have that moment, you know?
Yeah. If or when during the writing process do you start thinking about the audience, and do you feel you write for a certain audience?
I start thinking about the, I usually feel like I'm thinking about the audience all the time. Mm-hmm. And where they are in the story, and you know, some playwrights, it's like, I don't care. But I really feel like you know, they are a character in the play. They are a participant in this experience, and I feel like I never want to forget where they enter and where they might be confused, or where this is their story. Because I have written plays for Cornerstone and some other theater companies that write specifically for those communities, and that's been really interesting to bring back into my other work and thinking about, you know, are there veterans in the audience? Mm-hmm. Are there doctors and are there immigrants in the audience? You know, and how are they gonna experience this play? And where am I inviting them in? And where am I, you know, leaving them out? If I'm leaving them out, then I'm not doing it right, because this is their play,
right?
You know.
Do you ever try? I mean, if you're writing a play about war, would you try to get veterans to come and to really have a talk back or something?
Yeah, that's a play I wrote called Welcome Home, Jenny Sutter, which was done at Oregon Shakespeare Festival and then the Kennedy Center, and it's been done quite a bit around the country because it's spoke to, you know, a returning female vet from Iraq, and I felt that I wanted to write a play that a military audience could sit in, and I felt like a lot of the plays written about war are not plays that any active or veteran could sit through, because they're not written, they're finger-wagging plays about war, and I didn't feel like that was the kind of play to invite them in. I really wanted to write a play where civilian and military could sit in the audience together and sit with the question together of, what do you do with how do you welcome someone home from war when you don't believe in it?
Yeah.
And in that war. So that was very interesting and effective and felt like a big success in that way, you know. And the Oregon Shakespeare Festival did a great job, and they gave veterans free tickets, 2 free tickets wow. each. So they ensured that they would get to go. So it was great. It was great.
Have you ever heard anything from an audience member that has really stuck with you since you heard it? Or?
Yeah, I think, you know, a couple times audience members have come up. Remember, after that play, the opening, this old Marine came up and said, "You got it right."
Hmm.
You know? And after another play I did where there was a man had lost his family, and this widow came up to me, this man, old widow, said, "You got it right." So when the audience members come up and say, "You got it right," you know, that is huge. That is, like, better than any review or anything, you know, yeah. just to know that I got some experience right that they recognized, yeah.
Yeah. What kind of theater do you think is the easiest to get produced? Do you ever feel pressured to create plays that fit in with this mold?
That's a very good question. And that's one of the things I'm thinking about this whole week. Mm-hmm. I don't know what the theater mold is right now, to tell you the truth. I feel like there's not a lot of, like I said, the political theater, just big questions about life or the world we're living in is not in fashion right now.
Mm.
It's, and that's really not where I'm interested. So, I don't know. I don't know what to do about it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Because I feel right now the economic divide is so great.
Yeah.
And theater is not recognizing that. And not addressing it in the plays that we're producing.
Yeah.
And so are we speaking to just a privileged audience?
Right. Yeah.
And if that's what's happening, then we are living in a bubble. And at some point we have to, yeah, there's a whole world of people that can't either come into the theater and see, and nor do are they going to see stories that that represent them.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's like a really good point.
And it happened, you know, I think it happened, something happened when theaters didn't let actors smoke on stage.
Hmm.
A lot of theaters don't allow smoking. I think even there's laws against it. A whole class of people got wiped out from being represented on stage simply by that no smoking.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, like, I thought that there were sort of smoking substitutes. So
well, there's herbal cigarettes, and now there's, like, you know, now there's smoke. They're just recently having all these, you know.
Oh, but there was a time where there really wasn't anything to use?
Just herbal cigarettes, and those people don't like either.
Yeah.
You know, audiences really react. Now the audiences are trained, and they hate any kind of smoke.
Yeah.
You know? But that's a whole, you know, kind of class of people that smoke, or, you know, all from wherever in the economic spectrum, can't be represented on stage just simply because we don't allow smoking.
Can you think of any other examples like that? That's really interesting that a simple act could alienate people.
Right.
Or lack of showing an act.
Right.
Alienate people.
No, that comes pretty clear, but I think it's hard anyway for theater to represent like down and out people effectively without making a comment on it.
Mm-hmm.
And I wonder, can they represent really strong women without making a comment on those women being judged for being bitchy, or, you know, do they get placed in a certain category when they show those kind of strong?
Yeah, I mean, because if a woman raises her voice, she's automatically questioned for being bitchy. But if you hear a lot of men.
Right.
Shouting on stage, nobody questions
right.
it.
Right, right.
Yeah.
And if the play has a certain kind of emotional, if the play is written by a woman and it has a certain kind of emotional feel, it's being pegged as for Lifetime. It gets compared to a Lifetime movie, mm-hmm. which is like death for a playwright.
Yeah.
It is. Yeah. You know, and that's, we're not held by the same standards as men are. We mm-hmm. really, we just aren't. You know, and,
Can you speak more to that? I don't know is there any examples that you can think of being sort of held to a different standard?
I feel like as writers, we have to be nice.
Hmm.
We have to be accommodating. And I think that certain things that happen on stage, I feel like men get away, are less dramaturged to death as women are.
Hmm. That's interesting. But, like, I don't know if you have any examples to share.
I feel like, and that, you know, I could be totally wrong, but I feel like, I think Annie Baker, actually, though, when the Flick played in New York, they let it be whatever it was, 3 hours, whatever. And that's a new, and I thought, great, they let a woman do whatever. And it had mixed reactions. Mm. And then it won the Pulitzer, right?
Right.
I think that's rare. Mm. That was a rare instance that they really let a woman just let her freak fly, freak flag fly, and not worry what the audience thinks. I just think that women are much more, they're given notes to kind of just keep wearing them down.
Mm.
I feel like you could see an Adam Rapp play, and he has been given liberty to do whatever he wants on stage, and I don't think women are often given that liberty to mm-hmm. just, you want to do, just do it, sister. That's your play?
Yeah.
Without question. I feel like we have to defend our choices a little bit more.
Hmm. Yeah.
I could be wrong.
I mean, I don't know. You sound right to me.
So it'll be interesting in your studies to see if that, you know, if other women feel, I don't know what, have you interviewed Melinda Lopez?
I did, and actually I was going to tell you that she said that she feels that playwrights are being conditioned to write an hour and a half plays without intermission, and how, and also very small casts, and how that kind of limits creativity. You know, you have to do a very condensed bubble, I guess, if you will, about, you know, a very short situation. Maybe it's a real-time play, maybe it's not, but, and I thought that was really interesting. And also she was talking about how a lot of theaters are trying to encourage stage readings, and how if, you know, maybe a play doesn't really work in a stage reading. Maybe it says in the script that a helicopter comes through. And
right.
What do you do in that situation? Because
right.
that won't do it justice to say, you know, a stage reading, a helicopter comes through. Like, that really won't.
Yeah, it doesn't. Because they're not going to give you the sound effect of a helicopter
no.
coming through, you know. Yeah, and then that often they won't produce that. That will be your, you know, that will be its public outing.
Right.
It won't get a production. But they
right.
will have given it a stage reading. Yeah, I think that's true. I think that there is definitely a push towards the 90-minute get in and get out
mm-hmm.
stories, you know. And sometimes things are messy. If it's messy, you need to be in, it may be 2 hours, 3 hours, you know. But I think it's, yeah, people are loath to write those plays right now, you know.
Yeah. Are there characters or plays that you still haven't found a place for? Are there outside forces that have prevented you from writing these characters or plays?
Oh, I have a bunch of those right
yeah?
now. Yeah? Yeah, I'm at a weird stage in my career where I have, like, 4 plays that were written as commissions that they didn't end up producing.
Hmm.
They got stage readings, or they... I don't quite know what to do with that. I have these characters who are just, like, sitting muffled in a box, you know.
Yeah.
And, Yeah, it's a very odd feeling when you've spent a lot of time with characters and then suddenly they just kind of, they don't get their life, you know? It's not uncommon.
Right.
But you've envisioned the best for them and then they still sit kind of... And one play of mine, it's called Wake Up, Mrs. Moore, and it's a big brawl, you know, it's like a 2-hour big chunk of a play, and it's about a woman in 1970 who goes to her first feminist rally.
Mm.
She's a feminist, young, married, goes to her first feminist rally, gets knocked on the head by a beer can from some like redneck, and goes into a coma for 40 years and wakes up now.
Wow.
So the first half of the play is her living her coma life, like in living the feminist, she's living out all of the things that she, you know,
yeah,
would like to be, and then she wakes up 60-something, and this is the, you know, the world she wakes up in. And so the big question was, if you had been asleep for 40, I mean, the play, if it isn't produced, it'll be 50 years, but if you were a feminist in the 70s and woke up now, what would the world look like? Have we changed much?
Mm.
You know, what's different? Where would you be disillusioned? And that play just sits. You know, that's and that makes me sad because I really was excited about writing that play.
Yeah, that's really interesting. Yeah. Mm-hmm. So are you still trying to get that produced?
I am, yeah. And it's really written for the older theater audience members, for those women who are in the audience who lived through that time,
mm-hmm.
you know, who are now in their late 60s.
Mm-hmm.
And so in that way, I really did think about the audience members for that play, that they are women who remember, who have seen this whole 40-something year span of.
I was in the class Art of Protest. We were talking about how campus protest sort of has it gone down. I mean, because it's so rare to hear about anything on our campus, and how I guess, you know, in the 70s it was just so common to really go and to voice your opinion.
Yeah.
And, you know, we were just talking about how it's just not common anymore to stage a protest or to, you know, petition something or to, you know, and it's just, it's really interesting how that can kind of come in and out of being the norm. I don't know.
And what did you guys talk about? Why did you think that to be true? What were the kind of conversations that you guys had that spoke to that? Why did students feel like that was, there weren't protests in the way there used to be?
I just feel like we don't feel the power to question things. We get very frustrated sometimes with the administration, and we have lots of conversations about it, but we never really go the next step. And I don't really know why, and I don't know if it's sort of like the, you know, how the social media protest that, you know, it'll be a fad on Facebook for a week, and then somehow it just kind of, it just kind of fades from people's awareness, and that's what people are kind of trying to do instead, and then it never really goes anywhere.
Right.
But it's just really interesting how I never feel like I could organize, you know, a protest in the same way that I'm sure, you know, it's just, yeah.
I wonder if they feel like because it's been voiced on the web that that's enough, you know?
Yeah.
I don't know. It's the thing I think that technology has really kept us from actually taking action in a lot of ways, I think.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's not the same thing to write something online, and it doesn't have the same impact, I don't
as
think.
As standing with your body next to someone.
Yeah, there's some kind of it's a physical performance to stand and to really say, I want to talk about this, you know?
And I think theater is having the same problem.
Yeah.
Is not doing that same thing, is not taking the stage, literally, to just risk offending, risk, you know, it's funded by very wealthy people, and that God thank goodness, because that's how we stay afloat, but it doesn't want to, I don't know, I feel like it's not asking those big, difficult questions of the society right now.
Yeah, I went to see Lydia Diamond's new play, Smart People, and I really loved in her program, she said, you know, theater is about making people squirm. And I really, I don't know, that just really made a lot of sense to me. Because if you're sitting there and you're just receiving the same kind of information, then why, what's what are you gaining from it? Right. Unless you do kind of feel a little bit challenged in your views.
Yeah.
And, yeah. So that really mm-hmm. definitely resonated with me.
Yeah, I'm going to see it tomorrow night.
Oh, yeah?
So I'm looking forward to it, yeah.
Yeah. No, I just, mm-hmm. I thought it was really interesting, and she had a talk back, and she was talking a little bit more about that. Yeah.
So do you live here, but go to school in Connecticut?
Yeah.
And so you're doing your Mellon stuff all in Boston?
Yeah, mostly in Boston. Mm-hmm. So Ken is a resident playwright uh-huh. at New Dramatist, so he's going to try to get me to talk to some people there.
Oh, great. Yeah. Tina Binko.
So Tina Binko?
Is the actress. Because it'd be really interesting to talk to actresses and the type of parts they're getting.
Yeah, yeah.
Like, Tina Binko would be great.
Sure.
She's my age, and, like, a real New York favorite. Mm. And she'd be really smart to talk to, because I think she would give you a really insightful viewpoint on the type of parts she's playing. And,
yeah.
And, yeah. She'd be great. Yeah, that'll be... Going to New York and New Dramatist would be...
That would be really yeah. amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Emily Morris, if you get a chance to talk to her, who's
oh, yeah.
taking over New Dramatist.
Yeah.
She has a lot of very interesting things to say about gender as well.
Yeah.
And what's your... Is you have a question at the center of your...
My question is kind of, if or how are writers influenced by the statistics that it's harder to get produced? Mm-hmm. Like, you know, when you're... Do you just go through the writing process in a different... Mm-hmm. way, I guess, with a different mindset, and you know, I just that's kind of what I've been thinking about.
Oh, interesting.
And I wonder if it's going to change as I talk to more people,
mm-hmm.
Because I never really want playwrights to be offended or anything about sort of saying that, you know, well, I write how I write. That's how
right.
I do it. That's how I write. I don't identify as a woman playwright. I identify as a playwright. But I guess because I'm a theater and sociology major, I really can't now get out of my head that you. I feel like. You're not just a playwright, you're a woman playwright.
Yeah,
that's
yeah.
a part of your identity. So, I don't know.
Well, I think it's a good question, and I think that there are more women writing plays mm-hmm. now than ever. I mean, it certainly hasn't stopped any woman from writing a play. I mean, that really wants to write a play, that's not going to just keep doing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think. It's like I said, you can't tell someone it's going to be hard and they're not. No one
right.
But, you know, I've had the others that I've been sometimes the female playwright in the someone's season, you know?
Mm.
Like, that's been my slot.
Mm-hmm.
So, that's a way that it works in... I mean, it's one of a few ways it works in your advantage, right? Is that they need to put a woman in that
mm.
slot, so my play has been that, you know? And...
Does that put you in an uncomfortable position at all, though, being, like, the slot? I don't know, feeling like...
I'm just happy. I'm happy they had the slot.
Yeah.
No, that's someone fought for it.
Yeah.
Usually no. It's because someone fought for it and
yeah.
said, told someone at the top, you can't
have
a woman in your season.
Yeah.
You know? But there, you know, you want the play to do well so that they continue to... You know, if it doesn't do well, then that's some excuse that we'll see. No one came to see.
Right.
The female playwright we produce. But, you know, female playwrights do great.
Yeah.
You know, they sell as many plays. It's. I don't think you could ever argue that a female playwright doesn't sell plays.
Right. Yeah. And then there are the statistics about how many women are in the audience, and I think
yeah.
that... I mean, I'm sure that they'd rather mm-hmm. see a play that really makes more connection to them
right.
anyway, so, yeah.
It's just, you know, I mean, well, this isn't news, but most of the artistic directors are male, so
right.
they pick things that are, you know, speak to them, and, yeah, I've never felt like I've lived by that, less women are produced. Until recently, it's only hit me that the way we are judged is different.
Hmm.
It's never stopped me from working hard or trying to get my plays produced. But it's only recently that it's really hit me that we're judged by a different standard.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. My last question for you is actually going to be, how would gender parity in the theater look like to you? Mm-hmm. And I don't know, I mean, because that's such a hard question to answer, but do you think it would have to do with the, you know, the plays and how they're judged, perhaps?
It's funny, I'm less interested in gender parity right now than I am class and diversity and the types of stories we're telling. I could, you know, it's... yeah, that's just my beef right now. I feel like the types of stories are not, be it a male or a female, are not pushing the boundaries in ways that I feel like we should and could be. That I know the plays are out there.
Yeah.
I know they're there. It's just, you know, playwrights are super smart people, writing really interesting things. Yeah. That more saddens me than feeling like it's because of gender. I think it's more not taking risks on certain types of stories. Yeah. And they could be women, or they could be, you know, men. But yeah, that's more my current beef.
Yeah.
You know.
Yeah, no, definitely.
Yeah, I would never tell a budding female playwright to write anything but exactly what she wants to write, and just write it as strong and as amazing as she can, and just keep writing it. Every, you know, write 15 million plays if you have to, but yeah, should never try and accommodate American theater to get produced. Mm-hmm. I don't think.
Yeah. If you were a playwright starting today, mm-hmm. and you could sort of have somebody, you know, tell you anything, do you know, what would it be? Would it be that, or would it be
anything else? Oh my gosh, that's a good question. I would say, think about what kind of life you want to have. If you want to have kids, make sure you have kids. If you, and you know, find a way to have an income that means that you can have kids. Yeah, just think about the kind of life that you want, and that theater can't fill it all. It can't. Because I think I started out thinking that being a playwright would just fill all of my, you know, hopes and dreams of a life, and it did many, but it didn't cover, you know, there's a whole probably scope of things I never learned about because I just wanted to be a playwright. And mm-hmm. I think that the times now are different. This was 20 plus years ago, and I think now you really have to be an entrepreneur mm-hmm. as a young person. You have to know how to do many things, and you have to know how to be malleable to do many things.
Yeah.
You know, that's how you survive now, I think. And if you want certain things in your life, you know, figure out how to do it, and don't be so headstrong that there's only one way to do it, because I think that's an old world way. I think now it's you gotta having a life of many hats.
Well, thank you so much for talking
with
me.
Thank you.